Okay, Beruchim Abayim, ladies. We're studying Parashat Noach. Again, the most fascinating parasha, most tragic parasha, might be said the first Holocaust, where the whole entire world was obliterated, destroyed, in the Mabul, except for Noah and his family. The pasuk in last week's parasha, the last pasuk in last week's parasha says, the reason why Noah was saved, what did he have that everybody else didn't have? So the Torah says, V'Noach matzachen be'ene Adonai. That Noah found favor, or hen is they use charm, in the eyes of God, which means maybe Noah on his own didn't merit to be saved, but for some reason God found favor in him. There was something about Noah God liked. That's called hen. Probably the greatest beracha. If you went to a rabbi and asked, please give me a beracha, the greatest beracha you can ask for is hen. I don't know this on my own, but there's a story told that somebody went to the great Gaon of Yechezkel Avramsky and said, please, Chacham, give me a great beracha. He said, Umsachen v'sechel tov v'ene Elohim v'adam. That you should find charm in the eyes of God and in the eyes of people. Because once people love you, and once you have a charm, finished, and everything else is automatic. So the question he asked, he proved it. He said, for example, Esther, Queen Esther, how is she so effective in the palace with the Ahasuerus and everything? The Pasuk writes, she had hen. So that tells us, when the Jews left Egypt, why did the Egyptians give us all their money, let us go, give us whatever, all the gifts? So it says the Jewish people found hen in the eyes of the Egyptians. So the question the rabbis ask is, how do you get hen? Is it something you can, is it an inyan of luck? You have to be lucky to have it, that people love you? Or is it something that you can acquire? So I saw brought down in some of the Sefarim, they say that hen can be acquired. How? Through humility and derech eres, and a respect of people. Think for yourself. The humble person is always loved and respected. People love to be around humble people. To be around arrogant, egotistical people, it's disgusting, it's abominable. But a humble man, for example, that doesn't take credit for his success, that gives kavod to other people, so you love it automatically. There's a certain attraction to something. For example, Esther. Esther is in the palace, and I'm sorry for digressing to Purim, but it's a proof to this. Esther is in the palace, and she says, there's a plot against you, my dear king. They're trying to kill you, but that's not my information. I heard that from Mordechai. Now, once she does that, she gives the credit to the person that really deserves it and doesn't plagiarize the information. Automatically now, you have to love this. That's where the charm is. The same thing, humility and respect of people. So it is possible to gain this trait. They tell a story of the great Gaon of Akiva Eger. Akiva Eger was the chief rabbi of a city in Europe called Posen. He was once in a synagogue, and next to him was another great rabbi called the Chavot Da'at. They called him the Gaon Rabbi Yaakov Melisa, because he came from the city of Lisa. Two great rabbis of two great cities. So now came the third aliyah to the Sefer Torah, which is the coveted aliyah. So they tell Rabbi Akiva Eger, Bechavot, you take the aliyah. So he fainted on the spot. So nobody knew why he fainted. So the Gaon, Melisa, he says, I know what happened over here. He says, no doubt he fainted because he doesn't think he's worthy to receive this aliyah when I'm here. So he fainted because of humility. I'll handle it. So he whispers in Rabbi Akiva Eger's ear, and he says, you think they gave you the aliyah because you're bigger than me? That's not the reason why they gave you the aliyah. It's because the city of Posen has more people than the city of Lisa. So because of your constituency, because you're a rabbi over more people, so they're honoring you for that. It's not for you, it's for your people. So when he heard that, woke out of his coma, out of his trance, whatever he was in, and he took the aliyah. Now a man that has such humility like that, there's a charm he emanates. Everybody has to love such a man. Everybody wants to be close to such a man. So v'noach matzahen be'ainei Hashem, if one has charm, he indeed has everything. And now we begin Parashat Noach. Ele toledot Noach, Noach is sadik tamim haya bedorotav. Pasuk tells us Noah was a righteous man in his generation. So all the rabbis, Rashi especially, asked, what do you mean in his generation? Of course, he was living in his generation. He was a Sadiq in our generation, he wasn't alive in our generation. It's superfluous to tell us he was a Sadiq in his generation, that's obvious. So Rashi says, there's a whole story here. Some say, some rabbis say, in his generation, he was a Sadiq. Even though all the people around him were corrupt, you could imagine what would he would have been in a generation of tzaddikim. Meaning, it's the Torah is telling us a chiddush. If he was a tzaddik in his generation, wow, what Noah would have been in a generation of good people. If that's what he was in a generation of bad people, what would he have been in a generation of good people? That's the first opinion. Second opinion, the rabbis say, no. Noah was great in his generation. But if he was in the generation of Abraham, he wouldn't have been anything. Why? Why, if Noah lived in the generation of Abraham, specifically the generation of Abraham, that sounds like if he would have lived in another generation of Tzaddikim, he would have been great. But if he was living in the generation of specifically Abraham, he wouldn't have meant anything. Why? Because Noah, chas v'shalom, he was Sadiq, Tamim, Navi, and we're not allowed to talk bad about these great people, but the Torah points out a flaw. Noah's flaw was, for 120 years you built the Teba, you weren't able to persuade one guy that the flood's going to come to make Teshuvah. For 120 years, you couldn't give a speech, scare them, tell them, you didn't get one customer. One spoon that's going to come and say, you know what, maybe the guy's right. Maybe the guy says it's going to be a flood. Noah, I want to be with you on the Teba. So there's a failure there. The Zohar says that at the end of the day, you know whose fault the flood was? It's Noah's fault. Because he should have done something. He should have taken care of it. Unlike Abraham Avinu. Abraham Avinu lived in a generation of pagans, of the Avodah Zarah. The difference between Abraham and Noah was Abraham did the job. Abraham was able to convert the entire world, whoever, many, many people. So therefore the Gemara is saying, you're right. If Noah would have lived in a generation of Tzaddikim, another generation of Tzaddikim, he would have been a greater person. But specifically, there's no argument here. If he would have lived in Abraham's generation, then he wouldn't have amounted to anything. Because he couldn't get the job done. Abraham was able to speak to the people and catch them. Noah wasn't able to. The question is why. So I saw a fantastic thought from Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. Noah did rebuke the people, ladies. He did make speeches. He did warn them. What did he tell the people? He said, Rabotai, you're worshipping idols. You're worshipping idolatry, Avodah Zarah. Don't you know Avodah Zarah is worthless? Don't you know it can't do anything? Don't you know it's valueless? So Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky writes, it's a nice rebuke, but Noah, you missed the point. The people didn't believe in idolatry, really. The only reason why they were worshipping sticks and stones is because they wanted to commit immorality. If you believe in God, it's a contradiction. You can't really commit immorality because there's guilt, there's conscience. But if you're bowing down to the Buddha, so you know the Buddha can't see, can't hear, can't react, doesn't know anything. So when you're committing immorality, you're okay with it. So therefore, they knew Avodah Zarah was shtuyot, was frivolity, was a waste. But they were using that in order to justify a promiscuous lifestyle.
So Rav Yaakov says that was Noah's problem. He rebuked him on the wrong point. When he was getting up banging on the table, Avodah Zarah, Avodah Zarah, haram, no good. They were sitting and saying, oh, we know this already. That's not our issue over here. Our issue is immorality, and he's not talking about that. Avodah Zarah was a front. So that's what they're saying about Noah. Noah rebuked, but because he missed the point, like we see many times happens, the rabbis get up and give a speech, Agam, you missed the point, that's not the issue. You're rebuking them on Tefillin of Rabbeinu Tam, and they're Mechalel Shabbat. What are you talking? They didn't get the what you're talking about yet. But the scary thing, Yaakov Kamenetsky says, because of that, that he missed the mark on his rebuke, if he would be living in the time of Avraham Avinu, he would be considered not a tzaddik. Now, I wouldn't have said that. I would have said, okay, he's not a hakam, maybe. You know, okay, it could be, maybe he's not the best, the smartest. But what does tzaddik have to do with intellect? So Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky says, so may you learn, a real tzaddik has such love of his people and such concern for his people that he doesn't make a mistake on them. He reads them the right way. He understands their issues. He understands their problems. He understands what they have to hear. So if Noah is getting up and not speaking to the point, that means he didn't study his generation like he should have studied it. And therefore, not only is he not a hacham maybe, but already it takes away from his tzidkut. Because you can't be a tzaddik if you don't understand the people that you're talking to on their level, according to what they have to hear and according to what they have to know. Hence, both opinions agree with each other. If he was in another generation of tzaddikim, he would have been great. But if he was in the generation of Avraham, Noah wouldn't have been known. He wouldn't have been recognized because he wouldn't be able to bring the people back. Why? Because he misses the point in the rebuke. The Torah then tells us, Ele toledot Noah. These are the offspring of Noah. Now you'd expect right after this to hear the name of his children, Shem, Ham, Yafet. Very good. Doesn't say that. These are the offspring of Noah. You want to know who his offspring are? Noah is Sadiq Tamim. He was righteous. He did mitzvot. He was something. That's his offspring. So there's a fantastic midrash. The midrash says that God forbid there's a person, a couple that doesn't have children. So they go to God and they tell God, Borei Olam, it's not fair. I don't have any children. What did you do to me? It's not right. So God comes along and says, you're complaining? Don't you have Torah? Don't you have mitzvot? Don't you have good deeds? God tells that couple, that's the real offspring of a person. As the Pasuk says, Ele toledot Noah. You want to know his true offspring, you want to know his true descendants? Noah is Sadiq Tamim. It was his deeds. Because the deeds of a person are immortal. They live forever. Now this is a lesson to be learned. God, Baruch Hashem, God bless us, we have children. But the attitude towards children sometimes may be that we always want the best for our children, which is perfect. And some people might even say they live for their children, which is perfect. And they would sacrifice anything for their children, which is also perfect. The problem is, when we say sacrifice for your children, it might mean you won't go on a vacation for the benefit of your children. You might change your lifestyle for the benefit of your children. That's what we mean. But when Torah and mitzvot become sacrificed because of our children, what do I mean? It's not uncommon that you'll hear a man say, listen, I'm not cut out to really study Torah, to go to classes, to learn, but at least my son, he's in yeshiva, he's studying, so the spiritual accomplishments that I wasn't able to fulfill, so Baruch Hashem, my son will handle it. So he lives through his children. Here the Torah is telling you, no, no, no. While sacrifice for children is very important, but to sacrifice religion and put that burden on your children to take to fulfill your responsibility, this is unacceptable because your true offspring is your spiritual accomplishments in this world. Ele toledot. No, children are important, they're great. It's a responsibility to bring them up. But there's one more thing even more important than your children. It's your personal accomplishments of religion that is going to stand the test of time. And the proof of the pudding is, Noah, after he got off the Teba, he became the father of 70 nations. You know, every year we always say there's 70 nations in the world. Who's the father of all those 70 nations? They all came from Noah. From Noah's family, the world became the Chinese, the Japanese, all the different people in the world. Stem from who? Noah. So when you're talking about the descendants of Noah, you figure, Noah's descendants, the world! Doesn't say that. With all the people that he brought into the world, the Torah says his real descendants were Sadiq, Tamim. The Torah, the mitzvot that he accomplished, that supersedes, that overrides all the nations that he brought into the world. The spiritual descendants are much greater than the physical descendants. Torah continues and tells us a very difficult pasuk. Torah tells us the flood finally starts to fall. And this pasuk writes that Noah comes on the Teba, Vayavo Noah ala Teba, Mepene Me'am Mabul. It says Noah went on the Teba because of the flood. What does he mean he went on the Teba because of the flood? So Rashi says something astounding. Most people have a hard time interpreting it. In the Zechut of this class, I found something very nice. Rashi says even Noah was a skeptic. He really didn't believe the flood was coming. So he waited outside until the flood reached already his waist or his knees. So the flood pushed him on the Teba. It says, Vayavo Noah ila Teba. Why did he go on the Teba? Mipenei me'amabul. Because of the flood. The flood had to push him on. I mean, he's standing out there. It's pouring. It's raining. Noah says, nah, that's not going to happen. You built the Teba for 120 years. You came this far and you don't believe, so what did you get involved in the whole project for? After all your effort and everything, even Noah was a skeptic. How do you explain that? The Torah tells us he was Sadiq, Tamim, everything, and now you're telling me that he needed to be pushed by a wave, like a wave came and threw him on the Teba. And if it wasn't for that, he would have stayed out. How do you explain this? The explanation is as follows. Listen to an interesting story in the Gemara Baba Batra. The story is told, Rabbi Yochanan was giving a class. He said his class to his students, boys, when Mashiach comes, there's going to be stones that are going to be carved from the quarries, wherever they may be, and these are going to be gemstones. They're going to be the most precious commodities, and each stone is going to have the size of 30 amot by 30 amot. Each stone is going to be 60 feet by 60 feet. He's really telling the student, you're going to see diamonds, and you're going to see pearls, and you're going to see all sorts of rubies, 60 feet by 60 feet, they're going to be placed in the buildings of Yerushalayim. So and he brought a pasuk to prove it. And the pasuk is clear. So it says that one of the students in the class, he said, today we can't even find a diamond that's the size of an egg. You're telling me that there's going to be a diamond the size of 60 feet? I mean, subsequently, it says that student was on a boat. It was in the middle of the seas, and he saw some angels. Like this, he saw angels. And he sees the angels working and doing, so he tells the angels, what are you doing exactly? He says, oh, we're involved in, you know, preparing the stones for when Mashiach comes. So he says, well, tell me about these stones. Yeah, these stones over here, let me show you them. So the angels show the student the stones, 30 and more, 30 and more. He says, wow, she be genuine. So when he comes back from his voyage, he goes back to his rabbi, Rabbi Yochanan. He says, Rabbi, you're not going to believe, I saw the stones, unbelievable, you're right. So Rabbi Yochanan looks at him and says, what are you, making fun? He looked at him, and the student burnt, and he turned into ashes. Student died on him. He looked at him. He said, okay, making jokes over here? Burnt him into ashes. Interesting Gemara out here. First of all, I want you to understand the generation of Rabbi Yochanan. His level was very high. He was a tremendous, one of the greatest rabbis. He was the Gadol Ador. And his students undoubtedly were great people. Do I have to prove you that his student was great? His student saw angels. Any of you ever see angels? You might think you saw angels, but he actually saw an angel. So we're talking about great people. In the class, when Rabbi Yochanan said the statement, how come when the student reacted and said, you don't even find him the size of eggs, how come he didn't kill him on the spot over there? Obviously he wasn't talking to Rabbi Yochanan in the class. He probably turned to one of his friends and said, oh, what is he talking about this? So Rabbi didn't hear that statement. But when he comes back and he brings his rabbi a proof, he tells his rabbi, Hakam, you're right. The rabbi should say, thank you, Ruchi, you brought me a proof. I said something that sounded a little strange. Now I can tell my students, and if you don't believe me, this guy over here, he was there, he saw it. He should have thanked them. He should have told them, I love you. You proved something that was difficult to sell to the people. Instead, he tells them, you're making jokes, he kills them. The explanation is, how did Rabbi Yochanan know about these stones? Is a pasuk in the Torah that says it. Once Rabbi Yochanan read that pasuk, finished. I don't need any proofs anymore. Is there any bigger proof than a pasuk in the Torah? If the Torah says there's 30 amot, finished, I'm good. So when the student comes back and says, Rabbi, the truth of the matter is that there's really stones. So what do you mean? You didn't believe when I told it to you based on a pasuk? So the student might have answered, I believed you when you said it was a pasuk, but now I believe. You ever hear the saying, seeing is believing? Say, of course I trusted you, Haka. I wasn't doubting you in the class that the pasuk says what it is, but now that I saw it, Rabbi Yochanan was saying, for your level, the fact that you saw it shouldn't have added. You should have had that level of belief from the pasuk itself. Seeing is not believing. Believing comes without seeing. Not for us, but for the students of Rabbi Yochanan. It's like they found Noah's Ark. There was a big documentary. They found it in Turkey on one of the mountains. So you had people walking in the streets. Unbelievable. It really happened. So now that they found Noah's Ark, now already you believe it really happened. We're reading Parashat Noah for 5,000 years. But they found, and if they didn't find the Ark, so now you're skeptical. So what's this, 50-50, 60-40, 70-30? Now they found it, they're about, oh, now you believe it? So there's a claim. You should have, the fact that they found it should not have moved your belief an iota. It shouldn't make it look more real to you. It should have been just as real based on the pasuk. And that's what happened with Noah. Noah believed that Tevah was coming. If you told Noah, Noah, is there going to be a flood guaranteed? No question about it. 120 years before the flood came, ask him on day one, Noah, you buy into this flood story? 100% is going to happen. He believed. And then the rain started to fall. So what did Noah say to himself? Wow, now I believe. But now I believe. So you're seeing is believing. God says for you, Noah, that's being a skeptic. If the fact that it started to rain, it changed you, it moved you a little more to believe, for us, that's good. But for you, Noah, you heard from God already. God told you there's going to be a flood. So the fact that you saw some clouds, now you say, ha-ha, look at this. Not that he went from 0 to 100. He went from 99.999 to 100. The clouds got him, now it's... For that 0.1 decimal of a percentage, Rashi says you're a skeptic. For us, we would be called a tzaddik. But for Noah, on his level, it shouldn't have changed whether he saw or whether he didn't see. A great lesson in Bitachon. Torah then tells us, he's on the Teba. The flood's over. He wants to see if the flood is over, so he sends out the raven. The Orev, we call that in Hebrew. to see if he comes back with any vegetation or he's able to land. He was like a scout he sent out to see what's the story. So there's a midrash that says, why did he send out a raven? I mean, he has the whole zoo on the boat with him. There's every single bird, animal. So you want to tell me, he can't send that animal, it has to fly. Maybe there's a flood. Okay, so there's birds. How many birds are there in the world? Every bird was on the teva. So why did he send the raven? So the midrash writes that Noah tells the raven that, you know, what do we need you for anyway? You have really no value. You're not kosher. We can't eat you. You're not valid for a korban, obviously. You don't taste good, so even the goyim don't eat you. So therefore, you know, what do we need ravens for? So therefore, you know, go you be the guinea pig. So when God heard that, how Noah talked to the raven, he told the raven, don't worry about it. Your time will come, and I'm going to show the world that in your zechut, the world is going to have existence. Noah says you have no value, you're a nothing, you're zero, get out of here. Your time will come, raven. When did the time come of the raven? Eliyahu HaNavi, great prophet, lived in the times of King Ahav. Ahav in that generation, terrible. Idolatry all over the place. Eliyahu HaNavi, because of the decadence of the generation, made a vow, there's not going to be any rain. No more rain until I say so. And sure enough, there was a massive drought. So, right, 3 years. So the Navi wants to know, how did Eliyahu HaNavi eat? And he's living in the world. He doesn't live on Mars, he lives on the world now. So if there's a drought, he dies also. So he says, no. He was in the field, and every day, he would have a meal brought to him. By who? The ravens. The ravens would come with meat, a 7-course meal, set it up. Now, what does that mean? If it wasn't for the ravens, Eliyahu HaNavi would have died. If Eliyahu HaNavi dies, there's nobody that can bring back the rain. He took the rain back and he guaranteed he's going to bring the rain to the world. If there's no rain, the world doesn't exist. So who's really behind the salvation of the whole world? The ravens. The same raven that Noah said, you're nothing, you're worthless, get out of here. God says, you're talking about a raven? The only question is, why did he send a raven to Eliyahu HaNavi? Look how massive our Torah is. Go to another religion, ask them to give a speech on ravens. How long can they talk about? 3 seconds, 4 seconds, 5 seconds? There's nothing. There's not a subject in the Torah that does not have a plethora of information where you could discuss it and analyze it. So why did he send a raven to Eliyahu HaNavi? Let the cat bring him the food. Whatever. So explanation I heard is like this. The Gemara in Pesachim writes something about the nature of ravens. They're very, very friendly to each other. They love each other. There's great camaraderie in the world of ravens. Now that's significant because in most social arenas there's no camaraderie. All other animals compete against each other. They fight against each other. Domain, property, human beings on top of all of them. There's kin'ah, there's jealousy, there's competition. So the Gemara says, but the raven is the exception. The raven is one species that they get along. Not only do they get along with each other, the Gemara says, they love each other. A tremendous lesson you could learn from the raven. You see, Eliyahu HaNavi, he saw a generation in front of him, the generation of Ahav. They were idolaters. They worshipped Avodah Zarah. They were the worst people. So Eliyahu HaNavi said to himself, a worthless generation. They don't deserve rain. But you know something? In the generation of David, for example, King David, learning Torah was a renaissance period. This is every child in yeshiva and kindergarten knew all the Torah like already. He knew everything. But you know what? In the times of David HaMelech, when the Jews went out to war, people died. In the times of Ahav, when people went out to war, they won every single war. Makes sense. In the generation of religion, Torah and everything, David's generation, people died in war. In the generation of Abu Dazra, Achav, they went out to war, they didn't lose a man. See what the Gemara says? Because here in David and Melech's generation, they were very religious, they learned a lot of Torah. But there was a lot of contention between people. There was a lot of negative, in the religious groups, they would talk about each other, there was slander, there was Lashon Hara, there was negativity. It was a generation that was very pious, but there wasn't unity. There was a lot of schism, there was a lot of fragmented people. So therefore God says, Torah bijannim. But if you want to have success in wars, it has to be united. In Ahab's time, they went to church, Abu Dazara. We're not condoning it. God forbid, it's terrible. But they were united. Because they were united, there was peace amongst them. That was a redeeming factor that they won all their wars. So God is coming to Eliyahu HaNavi and telling Eliyahu HaNavi, learn from the raven. The raven you can't eat, it doesn't taste good, it's not kosher, can't bring it as a korban, it's got nothing. But Eliyahu HaNavi, one thing the raven does have, they love each other. There's peace amongst ravens. In the generation of Ahab, maybe you were too quick taking away the rain. Learn from the fact that the ravens get along with each other. At least this generation gets along with each other. They're bad. But they're not as bad as you think. Even that generation, there's something to be said. Don't discount any human being just like you can't discount the creature. So that's why when Noah sent the raven, God told the raven, no, don't worry, your time will come when not only you're going to save the world, but you're going to teach a lesson to a great Sadiq Eliyahu HaNavi on what it means, unity. It's a great lesson for us ladies also. Keep on coming to classes, by the way. Keep on studying Torah, further your education. I don't say no, I'd be out of business if you wouldn't do that. But that being said, just as important, if not more important, the camaraderie amongst yourselves, the Lashon Hara, David HaMelech's generation, as religious as they were not, they were vulnerable. They were still vulnerable because the attitude, there was baseless hatred between each other. All that talk, not in the religious camps. We're not talking about the people that don't learn. We don't expect from the people that don't learn. But the people that know, the people that are following the book, in the Ahav's generation, they didn't know anything. Abu Dazara, but at least one thing from the Torah they knew. That God loves it when people get along with each other. That means not looking down at people, goes without saying, the condescending looks and so on and so forth. We're all God's children, and therefore a great lesson to be learned. Even the children, of course, no question about it. Now listen to this, Pastor. When Noah comes off the Teba, it goes like this. He came off, Vayetzir Noach Ubanav, he came off with his sons, Ve'ishto, and his wife, and his daughters-in-law, and the animals, and the species, and everything. L'mishpechotehem yatzu min ha-teba. Hedush. They came out of the Teba with their families. This is something that was never in the world before, the concept of families. It's the first time you see the concept of families. The mishpacha is a family. It's the first time you see the concept of mishpacha. They came off the teba as families. That means when they went on the teba, they didn't go on as families. What does it mean? What, Noah wasn't a family with his kids before he got on? He only became a family after? The explanation is no, he wasn't a family. There was no such concept. Adam HaRishon was created individually. He was created alone. Before the Mabul, everybody lived independently. Of course, you had a mother, you had a father, you had kids and all that. But everybody was alone for it in their mind. They fended for themselves. They took care of themselves. There was nothing that brought people together. And look what happened. If I don't need you, so I disrespect you, I don't owe you anything, I don't have to honor you, I don't have to be decent with you, I don't have to be cordial, I don't have to tell you good morning, I don't need you, nothing, I'm my own man. That's how they lived before the Mabul. God said, no good like this. We need to create a world that there's a little cohesiveness between people, where people are already, where you need a social environment, where people are not living on earth alone. So what did God do? He put Noah's family on the Teba for a year together. And now already, you're on the Teba, you need help. Feeding all the animals, could you do this for me? Could you do that for me? Could you bring this upstairs? Could you bring this down? That's it, you need help. So what happened? They came on the Teba as individuals, but when they walked off the Teba, now they were a Mishpacha. Now, once a family was the greatest consequence of the flood. Now that changed the whole attitude of society going forward. Because if I'm a family, I need you and you need me, and we're relying on each other. Now already there's more respect between each other. Now already I have to be a little more fair to you. I have to be a little more honest to you. I have to be a little more. So therefore, one of the greatest results of the Mabul, the Torah tells us in one word, the invention of Mishpachot. God bless our community that we pride ourselves in this. There's a community in the world that can boast about the importance of family. Our community has the ability to live anywhere we want. But we choose to live on the same 20 blocks because we want to live next to our children and our grandchildren, and we want to be next to everybody, and we have to family together. We have to eat by the holidays and come. Don't discount that. Don't think that that's. I mean, no one ever thinks that anyway. But you have to reiterate how important it is. What it means that the community is addicted to this concept. Of Mishpacha. We want our children close to us. We want to see them often. We want to be next to them. It's a very important. Because of that, that's where the respect is built. Because everybody knows each other's issues. Therefore, we help each other. If we live independent, I don't know your problem. You don't know my problem. Finish. We're independent. We become selfish. But because we belong to a larger group, so automatically now we have to interact with each other. And therefore, it makes the world much better. A world without family is a world that Bar Minan, God said, cannot exist. He brought the flood as a result. Noah comes off to the Teba. The Pasuk writes that God tells Noah, fill the world now, start the world from scratch, be fruitful, multiply. You could slaughter animals now. You could eat meat. You see, until that time, nobody ate meat. Adam HaRishon was forbidden to eat meat. After the Teba, after the flood, so God told Noah, now you can slaughter animals. Forget about the reason. We'll do that next year. Why? Why he couldn't and why he was able to. But just one small point that there's a misconception. You hear people that come along and say that God would rather people to be vegetarians. Why? Because Adam HaRishon, look, Adam HaRishon, the perfect man, Gan Eden and everything, he didn't eat meat. So you see, only after Noah, so it's like a heter. God says, okay, we'll be lenient. If you want, you can have meat. Well, obviously, the fallacy in that thinking is that obviously Adam HaRishon in Gan Eden is not us on planet Earth. You're right. If we're going to live like Adam and Ishon in Gan Eden, then you don't have to wear clothes either, because he also walked around naked. So therefore, if you want to live like Adam and Ishon, it's a whole different program. You can't eat meat, and there's 20 other things you got to do. In any event, the Torah tells us it's permissible to slaughter animals. Following that pasuk, it says, however, you can't kill people. And the Torah says, you know why you can't kill people? Because man is created in the image of God. So Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky asks the question. He says, what does the Torah have to tell me a reason why I can't kill? Because I was created in the image. Would I have made a mistake? I mean, the Torah says, you're allowed to slaughter cows. So would I have made a mistake and said, oh, if you can slaughter cows, well, you can slaughter people. You tell a first grader, you see this gerbil over there, if you want to slaughter it, you can slaughter it. Oh, yeah? So can I slaughter my father? What are you talking about? Does somebody think like that? Who thinks like that? But it has to go out of its way and say, oh, you should know, you can't kill, and that gives you a reason why. Because you were created in the image of God. And if it wasn't for that reason, I forget about that reason, then you would be able to kill. The logic. You can kill animals, you can't kill people. What does the Torah have to give the reason for? So Yaakov says, very important. Yeah, you need this reason. Because, yeah, to most people at most times, murder is logical that it's not allowed and not permissible, and you don't have to prove it. But if you leave it to human intellect, there will come sometimes in a person's life where he'll say, here it's okay to kill. Here it's justified. If you let man decide logic, he'll tell you, yeah, 99 out of 100 times, oh, they're killing, of course you can't kill. Why? Why? I have to tell you why. But one time out of 100, he'll come along and say, for example, in the case of an abortion, they'll come along and say, well, it's different. This is, come on, the mother, Hazita, she's young, who's going to support the baby, the pressure, da-da. Oh, what happened? What happened to the logic? What happened to the gerbil, the mother, da-da? All of a sudden now, when you leave even simple things, like murder, to be interpreted to man, so you never know. One day I'll tell you no good, the other day I'll tell you good. And they'll be killing. I mean, you have a doctor could walk in, you're mushing, always go killing old ladies and taking their money. And you ask him, you're a murderer. No, this is not murder. Why is it not murder? So therefore, you'll have all forms of killings taking place, justifiable. So the Torah comes along and says, by the way, you can't kill. You know why? No, don't give reasons. I'm going to give you the reason. Because you're created in the image of God. Now get out of it. Once God gives you the reason now, there's nothing you're going to say. Thank you, Mitzvah. You're looking for your grand image of God. So he didn't say you can't kill because it's obvious. Because there's times where it's not so obvious. And in those times, God forbid, people will become animals. So the Torah has to come along and tell you the not so obvious reason. Because you were created in the image of God, and therefore there's no etir to kill, not because it makes sense to you. It's because it's an affront, God forbid, on Borei Olam himself. Let me say one more. I do. Let me say one more. Bonus. You don't want it? I won't give it. I won't give it bonus. It says that when Noah came off the Teba, he came off limping. He came off limping. So the Gemara says, why was he limping? This is because one night he was late in feeding the lion, and the lion kicked him and gave him he became lame because of that. So all the rabbis want to understand, hey, Noah, what was he doing? Why was he late feeding the lion? Well, was he swimming? Was he playing shuffleboard? What was he doing on the Teba? He was feeding another animal. It wasn't like he was delinquent. Hazit, the man had to feed single-handedly the whole animal kingdom. So it's not a bad record, by the way. You know, being late once. So therefore, it's obviously it's a punishment. The lion can't kick Noah unless God gives the power to the lion to kick him. Why should God punish Noah for that? So I once heard a long time ago from one of the rabbis, you're right. Generally speaking, if you're in the Bronx Zoo, and the zookeeper is late with feeding the lions, it's not the worst thing. And you might not deserve punishment. But you know why in Noah's situation it was a crime, it was bad? Because this was the only lion left. If this lion dies, finished. There's no more lions. If this lion is hungry, and you're late, he came an hour late, if he starves because of that, and therefore, so now the species is gone. So there's a difference when you have 10 million lions and you're late. Okay, so you have 10 million minus one. The lions will still be around. But the last lion left in the world, you better be very careful. What's the law? Now, what do we have to know that for? What does it mean to us? History? The lion bit him and kicked him. What big deal? What does it do for us? What it does for us is our children are the last of the existing Jews that are in the world today. Forget about conservative, forget about reform. Jewish religious children are an endangered species. You don't have too many of these children. So when a father and a mother is giving training to their children, in other generations where everybody was religious, where the world was religious, so therefore, okay, if it won't come from here, we have other people to perpetuate the religion. But in such a generation where there's so few of us left, a parent's responsibility is that much greater. It's like every child we have is the last lion. So therefore, if you're delinquent in your education to your children, if you're lazy in giving them Torah education, so it's not the same crime as it might have been in Halab, or it might have been in Europe 100, 200 years ago, when there was, it was evident there was enough people that could perpetuate. It's a very small amount. The Jews themselves are a small percentage, and the religious Jews are a percentage of a percentage. So the children are the last lion. Be very careful not to be late with their education. And that's the lesson why you have to. It's not about lions. It's about children. And therefore, train your children and be vigilant in order that Judaism will be able to perpetuate to the next generation. Okay, ladies, have a good day. This is from the board.